Hi, this is Bruce Ryder, Five Finger Death Punch, and you're listening to The Jay Franzi Show.
Welcome to The Jay Franzi Show, a behind-the-curtain look at the entertainment industry with insights you can't pay for and stories you've never heard. Now, here's your host, Jay Franzi.
Well, hello and welcome to the show. I am Jay Franzi, and if you are new here, this is where we take a deep dive into the entertainment industry to provide you with valuable insights and entertaining stories. This week, we get to talk with a recording artist and a Grammy-nominated singer-songwriter. We get to talk with Billy Yates, and we'll talk to him about what it's like writing songs for George Strait, Kenny Chesney, and George Jones, his decision to leave a major label and start all over again on his own. And we'll take a deep dive into what it's like to play on the road in other countries, including China. Now, I was lucky enough to meet Billy years ago at Sony Records, and I've followed his career ever since. He truly is the definition of country music, and I can't wait to catch up with him here tonight. So if you'd like to join in, comment, or fire off any questions, please head over to jfranzi.com. Now let's get started. All right, sir. Well, let's just jump in. I mean, you have a career that's amazing to me. You're a great singer-songwriter and a great artist, but you have written songs for some of the greats. So let's just start off there. What's it like writing for George Strait?
Oh, man, thank you so much. You know, George Strait was always one of my heroes, and George Strait was one of those guys that didn't write his own songs, and so you always had a shot at getting on one of those records. And so I would try, like, everything to get on those records and, you know, write songs that sound like George Strait. And finally, I was writing a song for a friend of mine. She asked me to write a song for her. She was diagnosed with cancer and was not doing well, and actually asked me to write a song for her funeral. And that song ended up becoming my first George Strait cut. And the cool thing was, I sang it at the funeral and also included her name on the song. Annette Grossberg was her name. And Byron Hill and I got together and wrote the song. We put her name on it. I went to the funeral, sang it, and made a recording of the song to hand out to all of her family and friends at the funeral. And someone there knew somebody who knew somebody who knew George Strait and got the song to him, and he recorded it. So that's how I got my George Strait cut.
Wow, that's got to be a lot of pressure.
It is. It's really tough. And I was fortunate, too, to get to go play the song for her before she passed. So she heard the song, loved the song, and also was able to tell her that, you know, we'd include her as a songwriter. And she was just thrilled to death about that. And so it's a very special song called My Infinite Love. It's on his Honky Tonkville record.
Wow, that's awesome. I mean, I'm so glad you had a chance to play for her before she passed, because, I mean, that's what it's all about, right? It's not about us after the fact. It's about her before.
Exactly. Exactly.
No, that's amazing. I wrote a song when my father passed away. I wrote a song for him, and it was after the fact, obviously. And he never got to hear it, but it meant a lot to me and to my family, so I can understand that.
Yeah.
So, I mean, some of these other people you've written songs for, I mean, I won't go down the list, but you have a huge list of accomplishments with songwriting. But how's it going from George Strait to, say, Kenny Chesney?
Oh, man. You know, I always said that, you know, if you kind of hung in there long enough, they start to kind of throw you a bone every now and then. And so hung in there long enough that finally, you know, a lot of things started happening. And the song that Kenny Chesney recorded was a song on his Me and You record, and it was a song called Turn for the Worse. That song was also recorded by a few other artists as well, but I'd been out doing shows with Kenny. I'd been out on the road doing a lot of shows with him. We were great friends back in the day, and so I would go out and just hang out more than anything, and he'd get me up on stage to sing a song or two, and we wrote a song or two, but he never recorded any of those. But he, after I wrote that song with Frank Dicus and Kerry Kurt Phillips, he called me up. He said, "Man, I really like that thing, and I'm gonna do it." And so, Turn for the Worse.
Well, I tell you, those are two completely different artists, in my opinion, going from George Strait to Kenny Chesney. But you've also got some others in there too. Some of my favorites. I mean, you got Sarah Evans, which is always been one of my favorites. But one that's a little lesser known that I really enjoy is Irene Kelly. How did that come about?
Well, we were writing together, you know, so Irene and I would just get together and write songs. And then as she we'd do another record or whatever, she'd pick something out that we'd written and record it. And so, you know, a lot of times it's just who you know, I guess.
Well, I guess if you know the co-writer, it works out perfect. But she's awesome. I mean, she's fantastic. And her voice is amazing.
Amazing voice and just a sweetheart of a lady. Just, you know, she's got it all. Irene Kelly, yeah. Need to go check her out.
Oh, she's fabulous. No, she really is. I've seen her play all over Nashville. I've been lucky enough to be up close watching her play and listening to her sing, and she's just fantastic. And the emotion is amazing as well.
Yeah.
But I mean, it's not just here in the States. You've done a lot overseas, but I graduated from a school in Australia, and you've had some success writing for people in Australia. So how does that even come about?
You know, I had, of course, moved to Nashville to be an artist. So singing was kind of my first love. And then songwriting was something I sort of got into as a secondary kind of thing. Because I moved to Nashville in 87, started writing songs around 92, something like that. And so I had various record deals. My first deal was a developmental deal at RCA. And then I had a deal on Curb Records. Then I was on Almo Sounds. I had a song called Flowers. It was like top 30, whatever record there. And then I went on to Sony and I was on Columbia Records there. And just after all those failed attempts, I decided that I would just start my own label. So around 2000, I started my own record label. And I'll never forget, I asked Alan Butler, was running the label at Sony. And I asked Alan my deal. And he said, what will you do if I let you go? And I said, well, I'll start my own label tomorrow. And I did. I called that label MOD record label, my own damn record label. Because I'd been through it with all the majors, you know. And so in that, you know, through doing that deal, I ended up promoting the records in Europe. People in Europe were really watching what was on the fringes. You know, people in Europe were all about more traditional country. And they just gravitated toward what I was doing. And so for 13 years, I toured Europe extensively, was really worked every country that there is over there, with just a couple of exceptions, Latvia and Lithuania, Eastern Europe, Poland, and then all of, you know, of course, Germany and Holland and places that you would expect, you know, and then UK, a lot of stuff in the UK as well. And I'm actually going back next year to do some shows. And so I'm kind of excited about that. After COVID hit, I wasn't able to do anything over there. And so then I finally, now I'm able to go back and do some of that. So excited about it.
Well, you are fairly loved over there, aren't you?
I like to think that I am. you know, made a lot of friends over there through the years. And I think if you're authentic and you just go and you know, the way I present my music is very real, very down to earth, but it's, you know, it's real country music. And then, you know, the other thing I think that's been kind of made what I've done over there work real well too is, you know, I'd be jet lagged. And so after, now these would be big, huge festivals, you know, thousands of people. And so after the show, you know, I'm wide awake, but I'm like, you know, it's like, you know, 2 o'clock in the afternoon for me. And it's, you know, 11, 12 o'clock at night for them. And maybe not that extreme, but anyway, but a big, you know, 6-7 hours time difference. And so I would go out, like pick up empty cups and help clean up the arena because I had nothing else to do. Let's go back to the hotel and twiddle my thumbs. That's so awesome. I would do that and just, you know, hang out with everybody. So just made a lot of great friends through that whole process.
That's awesome. I can't imagine the artists just sticking around, helping clean up and stuff. I mean, no wonder why they love you. I also saw in your credits that you wrote something for the Oak Ridge Boys.
Yeah, a couple of things for them. Try to think of what they are. But there was a Christmas song, Little Annie's Christmas Wish was one. And then Something in the Water was another song. This was all later in their career, of course, you know. During their heyday, I wasn't writing songs back then, but I've gotten to be good friends with those guys. And Dwayne, in particular, is just a great song guy. You know, loves to find, you know, special songs and loves a good story song. And I don't know, they're great guys.
I want to go back before I forget to ask you some of these questions here. You mentioned a few things I just want to make sure we touch on, and that's one of them, the song Flowers. So that was cut by a few people, wasn't it?
Yeah, Chris Young did that. Gene Watson did that. That may be about it. I don't know. I mean, there's I want to say Adam Harvey in Australia did it. And Adam's a great guy. And so, you know, that song has been recorded a few times. It's a really special song. And it's really the only song that I had any significant airplay on as an artist, you know, in the States. And so it's special to me for a lot of reasons. But when we do perform that song, just makes people stop and think. It's a song about drinking and driving, and it's really hopefully makes people stop and think. Love songs that do that.
It's a great song. It really is. And you talk about writing these songs, and I know you're a great songwriter, and I know you are the definition of country music, but what do you prefer? Do you prefer being an artist, or do you prefer being a songwriter?
You know, I've always considered myself an artist first, and I think I have more notoriety as a songwriter, especially, I mean, in the States. In Europe, I think people had several big hits over there as an artist, but people here think of me more as a songwriter, but I always saw myself as a singer first, and I think the reason for that is because I always just love the people. I love to go out and do the shows and love on them after the show, and as a songwriter, you know, you sit in a room with a co-writer maybe, and it's just not as gratifying, and you write something you think is special and everybody shoots it down and, you know, they say no, and then maybe eventually somebody will record it. But so I think being an artist is just a lot more gratifying, and so for that reason, if I had to choose between the two, and obviously probably wouldn't have to, but you know, hopefully you would, but I would have to say artist.
No, I could see that too. And do you stick around and sign every last autograph at the end of the show?
Oh yeah. And love to. I just love, you know, because I'm needy. And so, you know, if you do that, then you get that pat on the back and it's like, oh, you were great. So I think as an artist, we're all needy.
No, absolutely. I mean, that's the whole point of being an artist, isn't it? So then you found your way over at Sony, and who was it that you mentioned was running Sony at the time?
Alan Butler. And was kind enough to let me go. He said, you know, I was on Columbia, and he said, we'll move you over to Epic. We'll just change things up, and we'll go in a different direction as far as, you know, how we kind of staff this. And I just, you know, I'd been there for 3 years and just made a lot of friends in the building. But I just felt like it was time to move on. And he was gracious enough to let me go. And it was really the best thing that could have happened. I think, you know, if I had been Alan Jackson, you know, had that kind of success here in the States, it probably would have ruined my life. You know, I don't know, but you just have to wonder, you know, I always figure that God has a better plan, and it was just best for me to move on. And then doing my own label, having fun with that, there was, you know, really no pressure at that point. You're just kind of using what you learned from all the failed attempts at the major labels. You know, I'd sit in on all those marketing meetings, and I'd sit in on even uninvited, you know, I'd show up. Like,
that's awesome, too.
And, but I learned a lot. I learned a lot of what to do. And what's really cool, too, and you'll get a kick out of this, but this is back in the day. This was around 2000, and it was not a lot of independent artists at that point, you know, like self-promotion was not cool. So you had a team, or you had someone that was, you know, you had a publicist, and you had, you know, people around you that were pushing your career. And I couldn't afford any of that, but I was clever enough to create aliases. And so I had all these fake people around me. I built this whole team. They all had personalities. They all had email addresses, of course. And so I was writing all of my own PR. I was doing all that on my own, and nobody knew it because it wasn't cool to say, you know, I had to do that. So that was a lot of fun. I had a publicist that would schedule lunches during CRS, Country Radio Seminar. And of course, he would always cancel because something would always come up because he couldn't show up because he didn't exist.
So I actually met you at the time you were on Sony. It was probably early to mid 90s. And I guess they would have their radio parties,
yeah,
if nothing else, on Monday nights.
Every Monday evening, right?
It was Jack, right?
Yeah.
What was Jack's role at Sony?
He was head of promotion. He was head of radio promotion. And so, you know, he was the top guy, great guy. And he hosted a party in his office on Mondays. And a lot of the artists would come in. And of course, a lot of the people worked at the label would come in. And he had kind of an open bar. But they were waiting for the numbers to come in to see what songs had moved up the charts. And so that all came in on Monday. And so that's where we met.
Yeah, no, I mean, it was crazy. I would see you there every week. And it's funny how you say you go to the meetings and you want to be part of the marketing, and that there seemed to be a lot of the networking happened at those meetings. And it was just fun to be around for me. I didn't have anything to do with it, but it was fun to be there.
There was. You know, I think, too, for me, it was like you went in there to, one, just to hang out with your friends. But it was also, I was not having success. They were struggling with my career. and for a number of reasons. So it was a good opportunity for me to go in and try to win more people over at the label, because it's political, you know, like it or not. And so it was a good chance for me to go in and just hang out with every department in a relaxed setting with maybe a drink or two involved. And so, and also I remember being there one night, Billy Ray Cyrus was on Monument Records, which was under that same umbrella. Yep. He's like, Billy, go with me to the Longhorn. And we went over to Longhorn and he had his daughter with him. Miley was a little girl. And we went to the Longhorn and we have dinner. And while we're there, somebody approached him about, they were doing a benefit show at the Hall of Fame Hotel, Motor Lodge, or whatever it was called, over on Music Row. And so he's like, well, I've got my daughter with me and I can't really do that. So we're leaving and he goes, hey, you know, if you'll go over and just keep an eye on her, I'll get up and sing a song or two, try to help him out. And I said, yeah. So my claim to fame was I babysat Miley Cyrus.
That's awesome.
Her dad got it and, you know, raised probably several thousand dollars.
Right. You mentioned Billy Ray Cyrus, and it's funny because I remember going there and seeing him as well. And he came up to me one night. He's like, hey, Jay, you know, what's going on? He's like, you want a drink? I said, yeah, I'll go grab one. He goes, no, I'll make one for you. And he has me sit there and talk to his wife while he's in there making drinks. I'm like, okay, now Billy's playing bartender. I got it. No, I always say, too, he was the nicest guy at the time. Camera phones and stuff weren't a thing. And I was with somebody, and I'm like, hey, you know, I'm a big fan. They wanted to meet you. And so he said, how you want a picture? And we didn't have a camera or anything. And he's like, oh, no. He goes, my wife will take one and she'll email it to you. So, I mean, they were just nice people. And, you know, we've had a lot of those experiences over there, met a lot of nice people.
Yeah.
But at the time you were under that umbrella and things weren't going the way you wanted them to, what was going through your mind at that time?
A lot of frustration. At that point, I'd done 3 radio tours. I'd met everybody at radio, had lived through those times where you're in the car with a regional from the record label and they're pushing somebody else's record. They're swapping your spot out for somebody else. I mean, it was brutal. It seemed very ruthless. It seemed at the time, it was like, why am I wasting my time? And then something good would happen. So being very candid about all that, but enough time has passed. And everybody involved or everybody that knows, they know. And so it is what it is. And especially for me, that was, you know, after all these other kind of failed attempts at record deals, I felt like that was my last shot. So I'd made every compromise that they asked me to do. I was not as country for that record that we did there. They had me in like Armani suits and no hat. I was just, you know,
out of your element.
Someone in marketing, and I won't say who, but made a reference one day. He's like, we want you to be the country Ricky Martin. I'm like, look at this face. Dude, I look like Ricky. No. But I made a lot of compromises that I don't regret, because I think if I'd stood up more than I did, I wouldn't have lasted the 3 years that I gave them. But I learned a lot at Sony. I learned an awful lot. And a lot of people in marketing, a lot of people in publicity, they became great friends. And when I started my own label, I would get like anonymous packages in the mail of like record reviewers or whatever. And it was those people at Sony that just felt for me, because right, they knew who was against me. They knew who was for me. They knew all that. And when I took the bold step to just say, I want out. And at that point, nobody asked out record deals. I mean, that was unheard of. And in fact, I remember Pete Fisher was the manager at the Opry. And I started doing the Opry a lot. And he said, Billy, it's groundbreaking. He said, a lot of people followed suit. A lot of people took to greater heights. But asking out of deals, it's not working. It's like, look, you can't take away from me what I came here with. So walk away from it and do what you do. And don't feel like you have to have a major record label. And all of a sudden, you know, when I did that first record, it was called If I Could Go Back. And that record, I remember Tony Brown called me and I went to his office and he pulls that record and he goes, what is this? Like, how did you do this? It's like, you know, it's like, I just wrote some songs and recorded them. I don't know. It's like, you know, the better reviews than I am on my George Strait records, you know. And where's this County Q place? It's like a little studio I recorded. It's like we all, you know, did our song demos at and whatever. But it got the attention of a lot of people. And so it was the, by far, walking away from that was the smartest thing I ever did.
That's funny. County Q is a great place.
Oh, yeah. I was working on a project. I've been doing a Charlie Pride record for a long time. And I was doing a duet with Garth on the Charlie Pride record. And I'm doing a Zoom call with Garth, and he goes, man, he goes, you may not remember this. He said, but you remember doing demos at County Q all the time. It's like, of course I remember, you know. Remember me? It's like, of course I remember you, Garth. It's like, you know. Right. But you just met a lot of people. Man, Garth was singing a lot of demos back then at County Q. Joe Diffie was doing a lot. Buddy Jules sang a lot over there. Just tons of people, you know. Jeff Carson did a lot of song demos.
It's funny. I mean, we had Chris Luzinger on a couple weeks ago, and he was talking about his time with Garth and how he first started with him by recording the demos with him over at County Q.
Oh, yeah. From that, you know, he kind of was able to kind of step up to just a demo guy. He was became master guy. And a lot of guys did that, you know, kind of cut their teeth doing demos.
Of course. Everybody wants to do the masters. Same session, just get more money, you know. But I had an opportunity. I was used to be an engineer for Bob Bullock, and
yeah,
we would work with Chris a lot, and just getting to work with Chris was amazing to watch him play. God. Good times. You mentioned the marketing department and even the connections you made over at Sony. That's pretty cool that they were willing to reach out and help you like that. But you mentioned the marketing department. You ever spend any time down in the bomb shelter?
Yes.
I mean, isn't that the craziest place?
Yeah.
I mean, for those who don't know, there's a bomb shelter in Sony Records, and it's been turned into their graphic arts department, or at least it was at the time. I don't know what it is now, but it was a pretty cool place.
So that whole area in the building was part of Quonset Hut, which was you know, studio where all these classic records were recorded. So it had a lot of history in that building. And then they built everything kind of around that old Quonset Hut.
I remember going there, and you enter from the alley, and you walk through everything. It was just kind of funny.
And there was a Harry Henry. He was a security guard at the back. And so I'd go into meetings and whatever, and I'd come out and go, well, how'd it go? It's like, I'd spill my guts. No, he was probably the spy. He was probably like, going, oh, well, he said. You
know, like, this is what Billy said. He was a funny dude. I'd walk up to him, and I'd try to say something to him. He'd just, and open the door. Like, okay. When I'm leaving, he's like, how'd it go? What was it like? You have fun? Like, yeah, please don't hurt me. So you move on and you start your own label. I mean, that's got to be like a weight off your shoulders. What was the mindset you had going into your own label?
So the first thing I thought I was going to do was I thought, well, you know, the Texas music chart, like, you know, 40 reporting stations. And that's where I can't without my first fictitious record promoter. And so he would call the radio stations every week and try to get them to play my record. Of course, it was me. And he'd be like, Billy who? He's like, no, who's this? You know, what? Oh, man, no, you got to check him out. He's great. He's like, and so I did that. And I had a record called Two Country and Proud of It.
That's after you took the suit off and put the hat back on.
Yeah, they had this whole kind of rebellious thing going on the Texas scene. And so that'd be great. To put it out, and I ended up with like a top five record on there. So I ran it up the chart, but I wasn't selling records. You know, it was like, it's not really turning into anything here. And I'm going to have to go down. I started realizing I'm going to have to go down there and spend a lot of time. And I'm going to have to, you know, it's like, I don't know if I'm going to commit to that or not. And so all of a sudden, through that process and getting the airplay on the Texas music chart, I end up getting the attention of all these people in Europe. There was a guy named Cor Sane, and Cor lived in a little town outside of Amsterdam called Nieuwkoop. And Cor, just love you, man. And he had brought over like Garth and that. He had brought over, you know, Johnny Cash and Jerry Lee Lewis and all these people. And he was iconic and is. I mean, he's still alive, great guy. And he would bring all these people over. And I kept trying to get his attention. And so finally, he sent me a message that, hey, he apologized for not responding for, you know, 2 years. No, it wasn't that long. It was a few months. And he said, I'm going to be in Nashville. And so we met at Cracker Barrel. We sat down, we talked. And he said, I'll bring you over. And he said, we'll do a show. He said, I can't pay you anything. I'll pay all your expenses. You sell all the CDs you want to sell. He said, I'll bring you over and I'll invite a bunch of promoters from all over Europe. And so we did that. And I'll never forget, because I was thinking, you know, what would I charge if I go over? Like $1,000? I don't know. Plus my expenses. I think I sold like $3,000 in CDs that night. And I got booked on every festival that there was. It's like all of a sudden it exploded. And it's like, this is what I've been waiting on. And so I got booked on every big festival over there right off the bat. And so a few times I took bands over, but I found out it was easier. There was a band that he managed called Savannah. Great people, great friends of mine now. But they were a really big band in Holland. And so I started working a deal where we would go all over Europe. And so they would play 30 minutes and they would bring me on, you know, and I would do full 75 minutes, whatever, full show. And so that turned into just a great, great, great thing. And we did that for, like I said, about 13 years. And that was all, when you think about it, it's all just leaving Sony, working the Texas music thing, getting attention from that. All of a sudden, those people, you know, once Core took the chance on me to bring me over and try it, they were already aware. Like they'd been hearing my stuff through the whole Texas thing. So it was just like things fell into place.
It's more than that. You had some radio success over there too, right? Can you talk about that a little bit?
We had about, I think there was about 18 number ones. And there's not a real, like in Europe, there's not a real infrastructure like there is in the United States. There's not like, and you can't really track it. Like we have the BDS, and we have all these different ways to track airplay. So over there, it's like there's a country music show on Saturday that's a two-hour show. And so you're trying to get on that show. It's not something, you know, there's certain places in France, and different places, Switzerland, there's some, you know, full-time. And then, of course, UK, BBC does some country. And then in Ireland, it's huge. You know, country music is really big in Ireland. So there's certain pockets and certain places where you would get that airplay. And so the hard part was always trying to get them to play the same song so you get those multiple impressions. So you hear that same song over and over. You know, we finally get enough momentum that, you know, we could get them kind of up this chart. And it was all pretty cool. And so, you know, my hope is to do a new record and kind of relaunch that a little bit. I'm doing a lot of things. And the older I get, I'm 60, man. So I'm getting in that geezer mode. But but I still have a lot of drive. I mean, there's a lot of stuff going on. And but I love it. I don't like to just sit around. I have to sit around some. That's the bad news is with getting older is you have to kind of, you know.
It's not quite the same anymore.
No.
But, I mean, you get all that airplay over there. That's got to help put people in the seats, right? So, I mean, your shows have to be getting larger and the venues have to be reaching out to you at this point.
Yeah. I mean, they're eager to try to book me, you know, so. Through that whole process, you know, you get to know all these different promoters, all the radio people. You get to know everybody doing that and just, you know, make a lot of friendships. And so with that comes, you know, more bookings. And it's been nice, you know, being able to help a lot of my friends get over. They would come, you know, Buddy Jewel, Ray Scott, remember he got me on stage. It's like, how do just like, you know, at one point, like, I can't tell you, you know, I'd have to kill you. It's like, it's not going to happen. No. You know, it's been nice to be able to introduce other artists to that scene who are doing really well over there. You know, Buddy works over there a lot. Ray works over there a lot. And I won't take all the credit. It's not that at all. But, sure. You know, they've worked hard.
So when you when you're playing over there, does your fake team continue to help you work or are they more accepting of you as a one-man show?
They're all living on the beach now, you know. They're living the good life.
That's too funny. Well, you played all these countries over there, but you also had a chance to play in China. What's that like?
Oh, wow. That was crazy. Judy Seal takes a lot of artists over. She is a booking agent. She manages the Bellamy Brothers, and she takes a lot of people over. And so we got booked to do a show in Japan with Charlie Nagatani, and Charlie is a jewel, man. He is like the coolest guy ever. And so got to go over and do that. And so on that trip over, there was some sort of like exchange with the government, whatever, where we were going to do this show at this big theater in China. And so Ray Scott is on that show. We all go over to do the show in Japan and we have a ball, you know, then we pack up and we're going to fly into Beijing. And I don't know if we got off the plane and it was like, all of a sudden we're standing on the street waiting for our ride. And it's like, you know, everybody's like, are your eyes burning? He's like, are you? It's like, all of a sudden you're standing there. And it was just like, the air was kind of rancid. And I thought, this is going to be crazy. So we drive into Xi'an, which used to be the capital city of China. So it's a big city, lots of smog. I mean, we got to the hotel and you could not see across the street and it wasn't like fog. It was just, you know, muck in the air. And we get to the hotel. We go in the hotel, and it's a new hotel. It's probably a year old. It has probably not been cleaned since they built it. And so, and we're so tired. And so Judy goes upstairs. She's like, you know, we can't stay here. There's no sprinkler system.
Yeah, that's the problem.
Let's stay somewhere because we're ready to go to sleep, you know. And we finally get this other hotel, and then they run us out because there's some government people that want to stay. And so they throw the Americans out, you know. And so we finally, you know, landed some hotel. It was great, but it ended up being a great experience. Not that I would want to do it again necessarily. I'm probably being way too honest.
And the that's all right. Government that's watching. Yeah, they've been watching you for a while, and now they finally have it on you. But speaking of that, what are the challenges when you go into a country like that to play?
I mean, just sort of, you know, I mean, they didn't know what a steel guitar was. And we walked this beautiful theater, really nice theater. And I remember the steel guitar players start setting this stuff up. And because you've got this whole sound crew and, every, you know, they do concerts there. And they walk through, they're looking at this thing like it's a spaceship, you know, they've never seen one.
What do I do with this?
Like, oh, it's like, you know, where is this, you know, I don't know. So that was kind of funny. I think more than anything in a situation like that, it's like of course, there's a language barrier that's difficult, just kind of across the board. If, you know, like you go to Europe, everybody over there pretty much speaks a little English, so you can kind of get by. But in China, it's like, it's, you know, had an interpreter. Great guy.
You think.
And it's just like, you know, but it's different. And you walk down the street and you're in a country that's, you know, you're a foreigner and you are in a communist country and you see military people with guns on every corner and, you know, and you don't know what.
You don't know what is wrong.
Yeah. And so it's a little, you know, I'm just a country boy and I grew up in a town of about 1,000 people. It's 2000 now. So Donovan is my hometown. It's actually where I'm spending most of my time now. It's where I live now. And, you know, you go to a place like that and it's a little unnerving. It really is. But, you know, it was a great experience.
How was it received?
They loved it. And the only song performed that night the best I remember, the only song performed that night that they knew was Country Roads. And somebody kind of slipped that in our ears, like they know country. Like, so that was like so we all came back on stage.
That's your closer.
But they loved it. They enjoyed it. You know, it was kind of cool.
You mentioned them looking at the steel guitar, like, what is this? I think everybody here is looking at it the same way these days. It's like, what is this thing?
Yeah.
So you play all those countries over there, and did you have any favorites? Did one stand out to you more than another?
I mean, every country has its own thing and the food and all that kind of everything, you know, they're all kind of special, but I do have a fondness for Norway and it's just such a, and of course people in Europe all, you know, it's like they know, they go, it's like it's beautiful country. That's kind of my, you know, if I have to pick one, I actually wrote a song about it called On My Way to Norway.
Nice. So what was the food like? Let's forget the music for a second. What was the food like?
Like, of course, in Europe, you know, breakfast is kind of like cold cuts and cucumbers and bread and butter. And they put, you know, bread and butter the bread. And then they put lunch meat.
I think I could deal with that.
The first show I did in Sweden, I was over there with a buddy of mine named Red Jenkins. And Red's like a superstar country, you know, honky-tonk superstar in Sweden. Red passed away a year or two ago, but great guy. He brought me in and we've done this festival. So we're at the hotel breakfast the next morning, and so he said, "Oh, you have to try this is like a delicacy. It's like really, really good. It's like it looked like summer sausage or something, or like a pepperoni or something." You know, it's like okay. So I put it on my plate and stuff. Sitting there eating, it's like, yeah, it's pretty good. You know, it's kind of got spice. It's kind of like summer sausage or. And I said, "What's this?" It's horse meat. It's made out. They make it out of horse. It's like, okay, pretty tasty. You know.
Is that normal over there?
Yes, yeah, very normal.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Kill me. No.
I don't know what I ate.
Didn't ask. Don't want to know.
Like, don't tell me. You know, don't tell me.
That's funny. I see your hat. Can you tell me about your time at the Opry?
So I played the Opry the first time around 2099, 2000, somewhere in there. And since then, it's been like 52 times. It's just, you know, of course, growing up the way I did, you know, my mom and dad, my dad had a third grade education. My mom had an eighth grade education, and they loved country music. My dad was a barber, and they just loved music. And they had a Sunday morning radio show. And so they sang country gospel, and all the records around our house was George Jones and whatever. And it was the Opry every Saturday night. You know, we always tuned into the Opry. First time playing the Opry, I'll never forget. And I made it a special point to not forget. And I tell people that are doing the Opry the first time, it's like, trust me, take your time. Walking out there, I walked out and I said, the audience said, you need to give me a second because I really want to soak this in. And so I looked at the circle. And I'm like, just looked at the audience and just looked around, just took it in for a minute. And then I went into what I was going to do. Every time I do it, it's sort of the same way. And it, of course, every time you do it, I always assume it's the last time because it's invitation only. So I always figure they're not going to ask me back. And then so far they have, you know, like 52 times. But the last time I did it might be the last one. I don't know.
Never. You mentioned the circle. Can you tell us what the circle is all about?
So the circle on the Opry stage is that when they moved to the new Opry house from the Ryman Auditorium, the mother church, they took a circle out of that stage that Patsy Cline, everybody had stood on, and they brought it over to the new Opry house, and they embedded it in the floor of the Opry stage. And so you'll see a lot of artists refer to the circle. And of course, they have the Circle Network, and they have, you know, that's what that's about. And so it is special. And when I do the country classic show, sometimes they have those at the Ryman, and I can always stand back before I walk on stage, and I can envision, you know, Jim and Jesse in their rhinestone suits and Hank Snow, and it's just such a reverence. And then doing the Opry at the Ryman, because they do that, they do go back there certain times of the year and do the shows there. And so it's kind of cool too, because, you know, it was always notorious that Patsy Cline would walk in different ones, and, you know, Fair and Young, everybody would, Tootsie's Orchid Lounge was across the alley.
Right.
And so they would go and walk down there and, you know, have a drink and then come back to the Opry. So I always found out through the Opry at the Ryman, I always walk down, just take a little walk. I was telling the security guard, they know where I'm going, you know, drink a beer.
So you've had the chance to do that then?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Several times.
That's awesome. That was a big Hank Williams thing.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Yeah. And that's just such a reverence for that. Again, growing up the way I did, and my love for that, my respect for that is so huge. It's just so huge. Playing the Opry to me is like, if I never do play any other stage or whatever, you know, every time I do it is always just like, you feel like you've arrived.
You know, if you're playing there, you're dealing with the diehard country fans. And I mean, it's just awesome.
Yeah.
With all that said and all the experiences, all the writing for the best of the best, touring the world, what's been the best moment you can reflect back on?
You know, I would have to say, you know, a lot of the people that I've met, and I think, again, you know, when I talk about how I grew up, you know, my dad was a barber. I shined shoes in a barber shop until he fired me.
Get fired by your dad.
Yeah. And so that's when I knew that the music business, the rejection, I can deal with it. No, dad was great, but I did shine shoes there for a while, and I would go to the dime store every time I made some money. And he's like, you got to stay here. And he fired me. But I think, you know, the artists that I heard in the background as I was growing up were George Jones, Buck Owens. Growing up in a small town, you just don't know how to dream big enough to even think that you're going to ever meet those people, much less become friends with or write songs that would have an impact on their incredible careers. And that's, I think the biggest thing for me is the time I spent maybe riding around on George Jones' farm in his truck, or sitting down in his basement playing him songs, or, you know, getting married in his house, or, you know, sitting in Bakersfield with Buck Owens showing me all of Don Rich's personal belongings and the notes that Buck Owens wrote and the phone calls from Merle Haggard. And the, you know, those are the things that just, there's no value. There's no price tag. There's no, can't be bought. It's just something that happens. And and you just feel blessed. You just feel, you know, just feel like, I just feel like I wound up where I was supposed to wind up. And people, a lot of people watching, listening, you know, who is this guy? I don't know. And so I certainly don't, you know, ever want to say or do anything that puts myself on a pedestal, think it's wrong, but a lot of great things happened and a lot of great experiences occurred along the way. And I'm not done. There's more to do.
That's awesome. I've had a chance to work on projects for probably every one of those artists you just mentioned, but I've never had a chance to meet them.
Well,
you're a lucky man.
Okay. I can't. So if I look like I can't see. Oh, there we are.
You might want to take those off.
So, yeah, you know, a lot of our heroes, and sometimes, you know, you meet people that disappoint you. You know, you think, wow, I thought they were going to be much nicer.
Yeah, I think you're all right.
You caught them on a bad day maybe or something. I don't know. But, you know, I try not to judge, you know, my heroes. And it's like the ones I've met have all been great and have been super nice. And I was able to become friends with a lot of them. And it's been really special.
That's awesome. All right, sir. Well, we do this thing here that we call Unsung Heroes, where we take a moment to shine the light on somebody who might not typically get some credit. Do you have anybody who's helped you along the way that you might want to shine a little light on?
You know what, man? That's easy. Because would you do this thing, and especially to work in Europe, I'd go over and be like 6 weeks, you know, gone. And I've got a wife that, you know, we've been married for over 30 years, and she was never jealous. She never, you know, it's like she has always just been, she go to shows like back in the day when I was younger and prettier, it's like, you know, the girls and the whatever. And she's right there and was never intimidated by that. She knew I was going on with her, but she has always had my back. She has always had my back. I've got a great son who is trying to get into medical school. And so he is, he's awesome. So I've got a great family. I miss my mom and dad every day. They were a big part of that support. They always encouraged me, and they always trusted my judgment. They always had my back. They always, if there would have been a need, they would have defended me to the end. And so my family's that way. And so it's my family. Yeah, but definitely my wife. I mean, she's my princess.
That's great. When did you meet her?
So we grew up in the same town. So we grew up in Donovan. Donovan, Missouri is our hometown. It's a beautiful little town in southeast Missouri. Amazing river runs through it, Current River. The Current River is stunning. She grew up on the banks of that river. And so we met back home. So, you know, when we married, I was already starting to have some success. She knew the good and the bad and the, you know, so she wasn't falling in love with me because I had some kind of something going on. She fell in love with me because of who I was. And same with her. And so that's what's made it work. And that's what's made it last.
That's great. Did she make calls for you too on your team?
No, she wouldn't play along with that. She's like, that's a lot. Yeah.
That's great. I think it's funny. I mean, you do what you got to do. It's
brilliant. That's what I think. It's like, you know, if I'm going to pat myself on the back for anything, it's like thinking that up because I couldn't afford to have the team. And so, you know, to end up with all those personalities, that was fun.
Did anybody ever recognize you?
No, because they didn't know me. I'm still trying to sell them on me. So they didn't know me. So like, you know, like, hey, I'm, you know, I won't say who, because somebody's out there going, I thought that was real. There's still one of them that is still employed.
What's it like being the CMA Male Vocalist of the Year?
Man, that was like so awesome. They have a thing in England. And it covers all of the UK and Europe and whatever. And so they have a big award show. And so that was pretty awesome. I didn't get to be there for the show for that one. I went later. I went like the next year or something like that. And I thought I was going to maybe win something because they invited me to go. And I didn't. They invited me to accept an award because Vince Gill won. And so I accepted the award for Vince. And then I was playing the Opry, and Vince was going to be there. I was like, hey, I called him. I said, Vince, I got this thing I need to present. You know, we need to make a deal out of it. And he's like, oh, yeah, okay, it's fine. And so we have a picture. I'm presenting him as, you know, I think backstage at the Opry. But no, it's very cool. And, you know, just hey, to have anybody like what you do enough to say you won is nice.
Can you talk a little bit about your songwriting process?
Songwriting process. A lot of times, it comes different ways. I mean, you know, usually it starts with an idea. So I'll get a great idea or whatever, or my co-writer's got a great idea. And so we'll get together. If it's a co-written song, I write a lot by myself. Later, I've started writing more by myself. Not that, and I love co-writing because I love sitting in a room with somebody and trying to come up with something and trying to, I love that. I love that process and just the friendships and whatever that go into that. But the whole time that I had to be a co-writer, because I couldn't write a song by myself, I couldn't look people in the eye and call myself a songwriter. I always felt like, well, I'm a co-writer. I can write melodies, or I can't write a lyric, or I can't. And so I always struggled with that. It's like I was getting songs recorded or whatever, but I had friends that were writing the lyrics. I could write the melodies, and I could throw a little bit into the lyric thing. But once I got to the point that I was able to write songs by myself that were quality, and I'll never forget, I had put several records out in Europe, and a review I read said something to the effect of, you know, I have noticed that all of his songs have other writers on them. I was like, that really like insulted me. So a lot of those songs I wrote, they just sat in the room. There are other songs that some of them probably wrote more of, and I sat in the room. So, you know, it was always a give and take. But that really got me. And so I thought, okay, next record I put out, I'm writing everything 100%. And so I did. And I started, it really enjoyed, and especially as I was traveling in Europe a lot and just sitting in hotel rooms or hotel lobbies waiting for a ride or whatever, I'd write songs. And so I'd write a lot of songs on airplanes. I'd get the melody in my head and I'd sit and I'd write them, and I'd get on my phone. I'd like record the melody as much as I could to go to the bathroom, you know, whatever, or of course, or anything. So to answer the question, the process is, it varies. And so I think if you're co-writing, you bring whatever your strengths are, you know? And so initially for me, my strength was melody and phrasing. And I would write with people that just didn't have that. They could write lyrics, but they didn't have that strength. And so you just sort of, you know, complement each other. Then as I started writing more by myself, it just starts with an idea. And it's like, is that going to be an up-tempo ballad? What does that idea lend itself to? And then kind of start building. It's like putting a puzzle together. I sell real estate too.
Tell us about that.
Yeah, I do. So I do sell real estate, and I help a lot of people out with that. And I love it, man. It's a lot. That's been a new passion. So we have a company called PB Realty, a premier brokerage.
When you say real estate, what are we selling? Buildings, homes, land?
Mostly houses, lands, and, you know, commercial, you know, whatever. And so I've really gotten into it. I've been doing that for about 2 years in addition to the music, and it's been a lot of fun. And so we do a lot of referrals. So I have a lot of big properties in Nashville. Even I'm licensed in Missouri, but we have referrals in Nashville all around. So I can help anybody anywhere. And with marketing, a lot of it is with my music following. My social media numbers are pretty good. And so we put it out there in front of a lot of people. And my wife has her license, and my daughter-in-law has a week. So we have a team.
A real team.
A real team. That's right.
So what kind of similarities do you draw from the two industries?
A lot of the marketing piece of it, really. I mean, I think the big thing is like, you know, doing the music and being able, and especially doing my own thing. And we laughed about the fictitious people and all that stuff. But marketing, I had to market myself. And so just understanding is like, you know, how are people going to perceive this? And so when we take on a new listing, I mean, our pictures, and we go all out on marketing. And so stuff looks great. But the big deal is we put it in front of a lot of people. If you go to my Facebook page, sometimes I don't do a lot on my music page. I don't mix the two together as much there, but I do have my real estate page and I do have my personal page. And so you can go there and look around or whatever. But then I do have a website too called showmehomes.net. And so people go there and get information too. But it's, you know, it's just a lot of fun. But a lot of the seminaries is just the marketing, you know, putting it in front of a lot of people. The music is the same thing. And that's my son, who is now 22, playing guitar and singing.
Nice. And I know you mentioned that he was going to school, but I mean, does he get into it like you did?
Yeah, he does a lot of praise and worship. And his wife, our daughter-in-law, was like a top five finalist on America's Got Talent, and she's phenomenal. And they do praise and worship, so they work in churches.
Very cool. So you talk about marketing a lot. Can you tell me what your biggest lesson in marketing has been?
Wow. I think the biggest thing is just, to not serve the cake before it's baked. So get everything ready and then launch it. So be really strategic about how you get something together. If it's a record or if it's a whatever, make sure it's right before you put it out there. If it's graphics, you know, if you're doing graphics for to promote your records or your whatever you're doing, make sure it's spot on before you put it out there. So I always say, don't serve the cake before it's baked.
I love that.
We're doing this building in Branson, and so trying to get everything ready for that. It's like, man, make sure everything is perfect before we launch it, because, you know, I'd rather wait another month. It's easy to get over anxious and to put something out before it's ready. So I think with marketing, it's like, make sure everything is ready to go before you put it in front of people, because that first impression is so important. So making a record or writing a song or whatever that is.
Yeah, it's all part of your personal brand too. I mean, if you release something before it's ready, or if you release artwork that's not quite on point, you know, it says something about you as a person. And
it's very easy to get in a hurry. It's very easy to look at it and say, I think it's ready. I think it's good enough. Good enough's not good enough.
No, I agree. I mean, people talk about perfection all the time. And yeah, I mean, I want to be a perfectionist. I probably am a perfectionist, and I strive for perfection, but I don't ever think that I'm going to achieve it.
Yeah.
But I want to make sure that what I'm doing is the best possible thing that I can do. It may not be perfect, but if it's the best I can do, it's perfect for me.
Yeah, I think everybody should be their own worst critic. I mean, you should be hard on yourself when it comes to your product or whatever you're putting out there, whatever that is, you know. And especially, I think, when you're doing your own thing, too. I think, you know, like I was doing my own label. I was doing all my graphics for my album covers. I was, you know, I couldn't afford to pay anybody anything. And so I was just doing it all on my own. And then when I got to the point where I could afford, you know, like I was selling a lot of product or whatever, it's like, I didn't have to do it, so I don't need to hire anybody, you know, right. And I know what I want. You know, I know what I want that to look like. I know what I want that to be. I got pretty handy with Photoshop and, you know, making everything look great. The same with houses. So it's the same concept, you know. You know, I go in and we take photos of houses, and in my photos, you don't see like electrical cords coming out of lamps. You don't see, I just clean them up and make them look like, wow. And it's not to be misleading, it's just to make it look sharp. You know, people right. walk in, electrical cords, but just get them in the house, you know, get them in there to see it. And then, you know, hopefully they buy it.
Yeah, no, that makes perfect sense. I mean, I don't think that's misleading at all. I think that's just trying to make something look as good as it can possibly look.
Yeah.
No, absolutely. I do the same thing. I mean, I have a website and I've done it myself from day one. I've had it for years, decades at this point, but I do my own website. I do my own promotion. I do my own artwork. I do my own engineering. Even tonight, I was telling you before the show that I'm producing the show tonight by myself.
Yeah.
Just because I can. There's no need to worry about it.
You don't have to rely on other people to get it done. Oh, and you find yourself frustrated. It's like they didn't do it to your liking, so you should have just done it. If you can do it, yeah. Do it.
Yeah. I mean, and there are people who can do it to your liking. There's people that can do better. Yeah. So, I mean, when that's the case, especially in music, when I go into a recording studio, I bring in musicians who can do things much better than I ever could. So, yeah, I mean, there's a time and a place for everything.
Yeah.
All right, sir. Well, I really do appreciate you coming on tonight. I've had a blast, and I really am your biggest fan, I'm sure. So thank you.
Thank you.
I will give you the opportunity. Any last words for us?
Man, I just want to thank you and you know, for doing this sort of thing and giving people like me an opportunity to kind of tell our story and whatever. And go check out what I got going on. Go to the website, all that stuff. But man, just my advice is to everyone is to just be blessed and be happy and live life like every day's your last. Now, I've lost some really close people to me. I was working on a Charlie Pride record and I lost Charlie in the middle of that. And so I lost my mom and dad recently. And so just, you know, just savor life.
Now, I hope you enjoyed this conversation as much as I did. Billy truly is an amazing talent, and what a great guy. So please join me in giving him a big thanks for taking the time to share his stories with us. And thank you for taking the time to hang with me here. I really do appreciate it. If you enjoyed this episode, please share it with a friend. You can do that and find the links to everything mentioned over at jfranzi.com/episode23. Thanks again for listening, and I'll catch you next week.
Thanks for listening to The Jay Franzi Show. Make sure you visit us at jfranzi.com. Follow, connect, and say hello. This episode has been brought to you by VR Knives, your source for 100% custom knives made by a true rock star. So, if you're in the market for a new piece of art, reach out to VR Knives. 407-421-5528. 407-421-5528.